particularly naughty children. I got told off recently by a colleague for using that term. They said, you mustn't use that. And I said, well, that's what how society sees them, and that is the reason why they're being engaged in these activities. Anyway, so that's where this project is coming from. Really as a way of putting what we're doing now into a bit of a historical context. I think quite a lot of the nature-based interventions that come often from third sector organisations, often from very kind of sort of patchwork system of really kind of well-meaning people trying to do good on very, very limited budgets, but often kind of tied up in this narrative of we've just had this brainwave. This is a really good kind of new idea. Let's use some nature. Let's get these kids outside. So this is a slightly tongue-in-cheek way of saying, actually, hang on a minute, this isn't particularly new. Let's see how the Victorians did this, and perhaps let's see how not to do it now. So I was really pleased that Dominique talked a lot about this, the idea of the rural idyll and the use of outdoor green space in health and well-being interventions. And Dominique was talking about attention restoration. We've also, many of you will be familiar with ideas around biophilia and other kind of theories from environmental psychology underpinning various different logics, all these different theories out there about why nature might be good for people, but with a kind of overriding message that, yes, it is good. It is good to be outside in nature. It's good for our mental health and well-being. It's good for our kind of emotional resiliency. It makes you cleverer. It makes you less likely to get common colds or flu, etc., etc., etc. And then we get this kind of argument, this idea of an intergenerational decline in access to nature. So the work of Richard Louv around The Last Child in the Woods, adding to lots and lots of voices, showing how the lives of people, and particularly young people, are being divorced from nature. This idea that we have our children have less access to green outdoor spaces for independent play, for independent mobility than we did, than our parents did, than our grandparents did. So this very strong rhetoric of an intergenerational decline in this access, and therefore a kind of understanding that we are worse off in all of those, because we're not getting all those benefits that mentioned. But I would argue that this concept of an intergenerational decline in access to bucolic nature is classed and racialized. That actually, access to these outdoor green spaces since the Industrial Revolution has not been an experience for everybody. It's been an experience for people who live in the countryside. It's been an experience for the middle class. It's been an experience of the white middle class. Which takes us to this idea of the myth of the rural idyll, this kind of contemporary critique of the countryside as this kind of bucolic place of wonderment, of leisure, and the answer to all our problems. But, as we all know, there is this long history of the use of rural spaces for the removal of problematic people. So there might not be a long history of these outdoor spaces as providing leisure opportunities for most people, but there has been a specific use. So Chris is in the room, and we all know that Chris has done this really interesting, engaging work
around the location of asylums, keeping the mad and undesirable out of sight and out of mind. And more recently, my kind of interest has been informed by Chris's work around the use of nature as a tool for educating the uneducable. So this is a report about a particular idiot school that was visited. It's one of those things, I put that picture there and I was sure that I would remember exactly what it said on the cover and who it was. But this is a report of a British doctor who's gone out to visit a idiot school in the Alps, who talks about the exhilarating mountain air combining with gymnastic exercises together with the mental effect produced by the scenes in the midst of which they live are, as we shall presently see, among the remedies upon which Dr. J places much dependence for accomplishing the cure of the imbecile minds and feeble bodies which are placed under his charge. So this idea of the importance of the kind of alpine landscape as a site for educating children who were considered otherwise to be incapable of learning and functioning. There's also a long history of the use of rural spaces for the removal of problematic people in a more of a kind of obvious carceral sense. Sorry, going back there. I think particularly, and as I say, I'm not a carceral geographer, but my kind of initial foray into carceral geography seems to be suggesting to me that rural prisons are perhaps more of a feature of the North American landscape than in the UK, or that there is that kind of preference for rural spaces, particularly in North America for prisons. We perhaps have slightly more urban prisons here. And zooming in on kind of children and youth and rural prisons. So this is Maitreya, which might be familiar to those of you keen on Foucault's Discipline and Punish. It was called a colony, a kind of school for deviant young people, sort of child criminals in France, which Foucault had used, was interested in as an example of reformatory practices. And it is seen to be a kind of model of youth incarceration that was brought over to the UK and informed the development of rural reformatory schools in the UK through the 19th century. So it was the 1854 Youthful Offenders Act that led to the establishment and development of residential reformatory institutions in England, including a number of reformatory farm schools. So at this time, young people, children who were convicted of a crime were still being punished for that crime in prison. So reformatory farm schools were not an alternative to prison, they were an addition to prison. So the idea was that a convicted 13-year-old would still go and spend a few weeks in prison, in an adult prison, as punishment, but then rather than being released back to their family, they were sent on to some kind of youth reformatory institution. So at this stage, in England, you have industrial schools, which were providing a sort of reformatory option that was a bit more urban. You also have these reformatory ships as well. Reformatory farms were taking young people in the Northwest, the reformatory farms, were taking young people who were not strong enough to go and work on a reformatory ship because that was seen as being more physically demanding than farming. So this research that I'm doing is drawing on a combination of academic papers and the archives of three reformatory schools based in the northwest of England: the Birkdale Farm School, the Fylde Farm School, and the Liverpool Farm School. So life at a reformatory farm school involved boys sleeping in large dormitories and sharing washing facilities, leading to the rapid spread of illness. The land was often polluted. These reform schools were given really grotty bits of land that nobody else wanted to use, that wasn't really going to be any good for farming. There were frequent serious accidents, including many deaths. There was corporal punishment, poor diets, very low quality education, and long hours of menial work. None of that might be particularly surprising. The conditions reflect a lack of money. Does that sound familiar? A lack of skilled labour and expertise in farming. There seemed to be this kind of rhetoric that if we send kids off to these reformatory farm schools, then these kids can kind of earn an income through farming, and then we don't have to, you know, it won't cost us any money to look after them. And farming is this really easy thing to do because you just put some seeds in the ground, right? And then you harvest it and sell it. And there wasn't really this understanding of actually this takes a lot of expertise, particularly when you've put these farm schools in these really kind of shoddy spaces. So there was this lack of income from farming, which kind of circles round to there being a lack of money. Also, and again, this kind of harks back to other papers that we've heard, this desire to be seen to punish. They needed to show that they weren't squandering donations and spoiling young criminals. So there was this idea that, you know, we need to be seen to be kind of working them. They need to have a difficult life. Also, a desire to keep peace with the neighbours and avoid undermining the local economy. So as with other kind of systems of slave labour, there was the potential that the reformatory farms, had they been doing things right, could have been able to undersell against local farmers, and there was this kind of recognition that we don't want to really annoy our neighbours by kind of underpricing them in local markets. So there you go, I've ended up finishing ahead of time because I was so worried about knocking up. So the bit that I skipped through, did I? Oh no, maybe I didn't write it at all. There you go. Okay, so the where this paper has really come from is first this interest in exploring the lived experience of these criminalised young people in these Victorian reformatory farm schools. But I was also really keen to there's not a lot of academic work out there on this area. There are some really interesting things to look at, but there's not loads of stuff. And I came across this paper by John Stack from 1979 that talked about the myth of the rural idyll. And he positions these Victorian reformatory schools as part of this myth. So this kind of philanthropic urge to get these young people out in nature, this idea that it'll be really beneficial for them, you know, much in the same way that many of these contemporary interventions are trying to get young people out into nature. But actually, the more I went through the archives, the more I read these stories of the kind of degradation and the squalor and the pollution and the corporal punishment, the more I really started to question this, and my own personal conclusion is actually this had nothing to do with benevolence, this had nothing to do with the myth of a rural idyll. This was about removing these young people out of sight, out of mind, to the countryside, but also to these cheap sites, the places where they could afford to buy land, and about removing these young people from their kind of contacts and networks. So when you read the kind of archival material, despite the fact that the young people living in these institutions are suffering from disease, from dirt, from degradation, from being in the school, from being in the institution, actually the narratives where you see those, that kind of language used, is when people are reflecting on the homes, the places that these young people come from. So yes, there is this idea of removing them to a better place, but very much based on this notion of the kind of disease and depravity coming from the home lives of these urban young people.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yep. Thanks, that was really interesting. I think I spotted in your slide something about also looking at some archives in New Zealand. Could you just fill us in on that a bit more?
Oh, thank you. yes, so... where's it gone? So I am excited and terrified in that at the end of January I'm going to go to archives in Auckland and Wellington for a fortnight to look at the Waikarea Reformatory School archive. So again, it's just another reformatory farm based in North Island, New Zealand, and the site is now a full-on adult prison, which is quite interesting because the sites in the UK have mostly just fallen into disrepair, like the slide that I was just showing, and also a kind of related piece of work that I'm really interested in, child migrants going from the UK to New Zealand. So I'm looking at archives of another kind of farm school, not a reformatory one.
Thanks very much. Really, really interesting stuff. I guess as geographers, we understand that the notions of childhood vary by space and time. And presumably in